This is Bootstrap Web, episode number 66. Welcome back, everybody. This is the podcast for you, the founder who learns by doing as you bootstrap your business online, just like we're doing. Today, we're going to talk about decision-making, the difficulties, the tips we've learned along the way, the tricks, some of the intellectual arguments surrounding it. It's going to be good. My name is Jordan, as always.
And I am Brian. So I am excellent. I am looking forward to this one. I think it'll be nice to get back having just an episode where we talk through a bunch of stuff. We've had a couple of guests on recently. We will have guests on again in the future, but we like to mix in these kind of episodes as well. So before we jump into our updates this week, I thought we'd just mention one of our newer iTunes reviews.
Nice.
Got a new one here. This one comes from someone by the name of Sether Zero. He says, or she says, not sure. Essential, applicable, actionable, 5 stars. As a college student, I'm bombarded with tons of information daily. However, the greatest advice and education I get on a weekly basis doesn't come from the classroom, but the Bootstrapped Web podcast. Brian and Jordan, thank you for being so willing to share your knowledge and experience with us. Well, thank you for tuning in, and glad to hear this is actually educational and not just two bozos blabbering on the internet. But
yeah, and good for he or she for getting to the sort of thing back in college. That's a head start for compared to most people.
Yeah, it really is amazing. Like how I really do find podcasts like educational if you're looking to get into a new field or a new industry. And not even necessarily just like here are things I can teach you, but more just like hearing, talking shop, hearing how people talk about stuff in the real world, real practitioners of things. I think it's super important. That's why I love podcasts, love tuning into stuff like this. So cool.
Agreed. And today being a bit more of a, let's call it regular episode, I feel like we haven't done an update in a while. So why don't we, before jumping into the decision-making topic, let's give a little bit of an update on us. It's been a while. I know I personally have some things that I've kind of kept private for a while that I'm looking forward to sharing, but why don't you kick things off with an update, Brian?
Yeah. I mean, me too. I've actually a lot going on my end right now that unfortunately I'm not really in a I can't really share too much of it. I hope I will in the next few weeks, but these past few weeks, it has been a huge mindset shift for me, and I'm going through a lot of changes, kind of personally and professionally, thinking through a whole lot of things, and that's a big reason why this episode topic came about today. But a couple of weeks ago, I did talk about that I'm in the process of kind of moving on from Restaurant Engine in terms of what I'll be focusing on full time. And so at first, about a month or two ago, I was really kind of like urgently looking for new products to get into, to start building and building into being the next thing. I've kind of put that whole thing on hold, and I'm stepping back from that whole process. And I'm trying to just, take some time and space to think through everything and explore all the different options. And I think, just to kind of see where that takes me. And, so that's kind of where I'm at from a mindset shift. One thing I know for sure is I want to be focusing on, the audience here and the newsletter subscribers. But the other thing I was listening to today was, Tropical MBA, as I always do almost every week, their episode 286, they were talking about, it was their comments on Alex Bloomberg's startup podcast. And so this was one of my favorite episodes of Tropical MBA so far. I just thought that their thoughts on the startup podcast were right on. And it is a really great podcast, that startup podcast, and hearing that story.
Entertainment wise, it's amazing.
It really is. And obviously, Alex Bloomberg, really knows how to produce a well produced podcast for sure. But yeah, like the story, as I was listening through it, getting into the VC stuff and launching this, his new venture, Gimlet Media, the podcast kind of network that he's starting. There were a lot of points in there where I was listening to it and I was just really questioning the whole direction. And I really just couldn't agree more with what Dan and Ian were saying about this in their episode this week. So we'll link that up in the show notes.
Yeah. And a lot of it had to do with the default thinking that was being done by Alex, that VC was the only path, that if you're going to do a tech startup, then you have to raise a bunch of money from VCs, and no other options were discussed. Like, maybe that's for narrative purposes, or a lot of it, I think, comes from the fact that Alex is an employee, right? Mm-hmm. He's worked for someone for a very long time. And I think bootstrapping and the mindset around bootstrapping would be pretty foreign to him. I think it would be more foreign to someone who's been a longtime employee than, hey, I'm going to do a startup, and that means what I think it means, what I always see and hear about.
Yeah,
and that means going to raise money.
Yeah, and you know, it did seem that way, and it seemed like the whole idea of bootstrapping or starting small and gaining traction and growing from there, like that it. At least the way that he told the story in the podcast, it's like almost like that didn't even occur to him, you know?
Yeah.
And I think
I'm
like,
not sure if that's right, but
right. That's how the story came across. And, mm-hmm. It's almost like, you know, well, I want to start a new company. I want to go out on my own for the first time. I guess this is what people do, right? They go get investors and VC. Like what else is there? And I think just that story or that mentality is so common. And maybe less so these days, but that's partly because we're in this circle, you know, but,
unfortunately with the popularity of this thing, I think it has reinforced very powerfully that exact stereotype and default thinking that when you do a startup, it means this path of VCs and raising a bunch of money.
Yeah.
The truth is even the VC industry isn't really like that anymore. Now there's a ton more seed stage,
yep.
And there are smaller amounts of money being put in at first. But it is interesting. I had a conversation with a friend recently who was telling me about trying to raise money for his company and how they made the mistake of starting the business and getting customers. And they said, hey, we're going to make some progress, and then we're going to show investors how much progress we made on such a limited budget and limited resources. And the problem with that was the numbers, the reality got in the way of the pitch. So they had said, this is how it's been going for 6 months. And all the investors came back with, well, it's not blowing up. So why should we invest? They really would have been better off, like Alex, to say, I have an idea. It's going to be huge. Give me money now, before the numbers and reality got in the way.
Yeah.
So it's a tricky thing. Once you enter that world, it's like a house of mirrors. You know, it's not quite the same type of reality that we deal with, where it's, you know, revenue, expenses, profit. Can you keep going? How much do you have to reinvest? Like, much more concrete.
Yeah. But I mean, like, when I got into doing products, and I came at it from a freelancer's point of view, I never got into this whole thing as like a dream of starting a business or really being an entrepreneur. It was only in recent years that I kind of started thinking of myself as an entrepreneur. And, you know, I always looked at it like, look, clients used to pay me for my time, and then it was like, well, let's try to build something that customers would pay for. You know, it that like the whole idea of getting investors and VC and all that stuff, just I knew it was out there, but it didn't really interest me, and it almost seemed like way overcomplicated. That was my path into all this. I would see guys like 80 and Woo Themes, and like, oh, I made a WordPress theme and sold it and paying customers and, mm-hmm. And then kind of grow from there. But,
yeah, that makes sense when you think of it that way. I didn't come from the freelance background into it. But I think, I guess I would say most of the bootstrap community and bootstrap kind of movement and mindset is from that point of view. And that makes a lot more sense that someone in that point of view wouldn't say, so I'm going to stop everything I'm doing. I'm going to stop making income entirely, and I'm going to go raise money for an idea. And then I'm going to take a salary and be like an employee working with investors and a board of directors. And it's kind of like, that's too big of a leap. Like, why would you do that?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly the mentality that I came at it from. And I think you're right. I think a lot of us in this space come to it in that direction. And I think that's why we're seeing more and more, like we were talking with Rob last week about the growing popularity and the growing community around the idea of micro ISVs, bootstrapping a startup, making the transition from a job or from client work into products.
Right. Well, I would say the majority of people come from that mindset. I don't, and I know a lot of people, I'm agnostic. I just want to make as much money as I possibly can, as quickly as I can, with as much freedom as I can. And sometimes those are all intention. But I always saw bootstrapping as just like the logical way to do it. Mm-hmm. It gives you the highest probability of success with the most control. And maybe it's not as potential money, as big of potential money as the VC thing, but it's much more likely. So maybe the expected return is higher. So it's that kind of calculation can lead you to the same place.
Yep. So right. So what cool. about your update this week?
Okay. So something I guess I've been kind of sitting on that I felt was necessary to keep private for a long time, and now it's no longer necessary. So I'll back up. In December, so a few months ago now, out of the blue, I get an email saying, "Hi, I'd like to discuss acquiring Carthook." Always a nice email to get. The X factor was that the email was from someone I recognized, a relatively well-known person in the online space. So I took it seriously. It was very exciting. So that increased and cranked up the intensity of the whole Carthook experience, let's say. It made things much more real. And it kind of made me perk up and pay attention and relook at Carthook as maybe a bigger opportunity than I was thinking. So the acquisition didn't work out for a number of reasons that I don't think is appropriate to get all the way into. But it didn't make sense at the end of the day. We decided to go our own ways and kind of wish each other luck. Very friendly. It was actually a great experience all the way around. I came away with it with more respect for the person than before. So it was a great experience that way. But what that did is it heightened expectations. And so once the decision was made to not do it and go our own separate ways, it almost left like this void of, wait a minute, I thought maybe this thing was going to go one direction, right? You can't let that influence that kind of a decision. It didn't make sense. And so just because the excitement was there, didn't make sense to just subordinate the business decision to the excitement, which was fine. I felt that was the appropriate
thing. Right. Because when you were envisioning the first option, like the acquisition, all of a sudden, the vision becomes something different. But then once that is now off the table, it's like, all right, well, how do we recreate that same sort of end vision given the current direction?
Exactly right. Going right back to the way I was doing things before almost seemed unreasonable. Like, so I'm just going to take whatever expectations and excitement had and just kind of go right back to keeping it on the side in a nice slow burn and doing some consulting and maybe some info products and that sort of thing. So that's kind of the explanation, one of the explanations for going all in on Carthook. Right. That's not the explanation. It's just it was one of the original triggers that said, wait a minute, maybe this thing is a bigger opportunity than I am giving it credit for. Let me relook at it again. And then that's what helped make the decision to say, you know what, in 2015, let's just go all the way in. Let's go all in on Carthook. With that void being there of excitement, I guess I don't know if you want to call it luck. It's not luck. What happened was I recently brought in a new co-founder, a partner, and I talked about that a little bit, but this is all part of the same story. A few weeks after we decided to go our own ways, the potential acquirer and I got a random opt-in to the lead magnet on carthook.com. But I am, I guess, aggressively minded, and this is where the part where luck leaves and action takes over. I saw someone sign up. I looked them up. I went to LinkedIn. I went to their Twitter profile. Turns out they work with a venture development fund in New York. So these are like these shops that are popping up in like New York and San Francisco and these markets that help groom and prepare companies to go the VC route. So at the very least, I said, you know what? That's interesting. Let me reach out to this person. So I reached out to them on Twitter and said, hey, I saw you signed up. I saw you work for this cool looking company. You know, what's the deal? Do you want to talk? They came back to me and said, actually, it's not about me. It's about my superior, my boss who asked me to look into things. So I said, all right, cool. Let's dig further into this. Another few days led to someone else signing up for the lead magnet. And I saw that they were linked to them on Twitter and on LinkedIn. And I said, wait a minute, this is all a conspiracy. Something's happening behind the scenes. People are talking about me. I need to get involved in this and see what's going on. So that's when I kind of more aggressively pursued and said, look, let's talk. That is how I found my co-founder. So he opted in. Someone opted in, then told him about Cardhook from the MixerG interview. The 60 minutes that changed my life. Right. Everything comes out of that MixerG interview, yeah. More or less.
You told me about meeting the co-founder and everything, but I didn't realize that's actually how the dots were connected.
Oh yeah, and somebody signs up for the lead magnet, and Jordan Gall is not messing around.
Yeah, I wanted to clarify something. So about your lead magnet. Mm-hmm. You're like currently your current marketing strategies, you're not like driving a whole ton of traffic at the lead magnet. And that's why every few signups for the lead magnet are, you know, they're popping up and you're able to kind of look into them individually, right?
Yeah, I get a few. Sometimes I'll get a few in a day, then I'll have a few days that go without it. Yeah, but I'm not driving traffic to the marketing site. That's not the strategy right mm-hmm. now. It's all about like outbound and whatever else. But people who see the MixerG interview, go to the site.
Yeah. And that is just to sidebar from your story here.
Right.
Those of you who are starting something new at very low traffic, you get a handful of opt-ins. I mean, look what you can do. Look what you can make happen with just an email address. You know, you don't have to think don't think in thousands. And if you're not getting thousands of subscribers, things aren't happening. You know, start Googling, start digging into each and every one of those first few opt-ins, and who knows mm-hmm. what can happen, you know?
Yeah, and don't think in terms of the internet and email and Twitter. Like, business happens in the real world. So make things transfer from online to the real world whenever you possibly can. So that's what I did. So I kind of pursued this and figured out exactly who it was and everything. And I said, look, let's get on the phone. So that was the first time I spoke with my co-founder after that. His name is Ben Fisher. He's done a few really, really cool companies. Used to be in ad tech. So like advertising technology and advertising companies. He's got a design background. He's a developer. He built a company called Alchemy. He started a Lean Startup Machine. Just a bunch of cool stuff. He's a New York guy. So it turns out he's like been looking into e-commerce for a while. So we got on the phone and just hit it off for like an hour and a half conversation about e-commerce, about SaaS, about just the mindset behind this business and all these things that go into it. So then we basically said, cool, great to meet you. Let's see what happens. Let's be in touch. So I had the feeling like this is supposed to work out. Like this weird email opt-in Twitter like roundabout thing, and then all of a sudden I get on the phone and hit it off with this guy. Our skills are perfectly complementary. I was like, this is something. This is worth pursuing. So,
but how was he connected to the first
He was a friend.
Okay,
he's a friend in New York, and the friend that first opted in and saw the MixerG interview and all that knew that Ben was looking into the e-commerce world in general. And so he said, hey, Ben, you should check this guy out.
Gotcha.
I just watched his interview. I checked out the site. So that's like a day later. That's why he signed up. Mm-hmm. So the day after we get on our first phone call, I threw out the Hail Mary. I was like, look, this might be weird, but I feel like, you know, this is this weird fate thing. Like, this is supposed to work out. Let's get back on the phone next week. So we got on the phone again, hit it off again for another hour. It's like dating. This is like, mm-hmm. Oh, it's so exciting. And, yep. You know,
We're completing each other's sentences.
Oh yeah, exactly. So then I just went full, bore aggressive. After that second phone call, I was like, look, man, let's not waste each other's time. Let's see if this is for real or for not. Like, is this love or is this fantasy? You know? So he happened to be in LA, and I was like, look, man, I'm going to come down there. I'm going to fly to LA. We're going to work together for a few days. We'll see how it goes. And he was like, all right, if you're willing to do it, you know, I showed a level of seriousness that commanded a serious response. Mm-hmm. Right? I was, look, I'm going to drop down $500, get on a flight from Portland down to LA. I'm going to not hang out with my kids and my wife, and I'm going to come hang out with you, and we're going to talk business. We're going to work together. And he was like, all right, if you want to come down here, then let's do it. That went well. And so the next step was him showing the love back. He was like, all right, I'm going to come to Portland. So he did the same thing. So 2 weeks later, he came up to Portland. We worked together again for another few days. And that's when things started to get, you know, nothing's 100% easy. So he and my original co-founder, Charlie, the original developer, you know how you get two developers working together. It's never straightforward.
Yeah, but now, just so I'm clear, Charlie, the original co-founder, from what I understand, he has kind of been out of the picture more recently in recent months, right? Like he's not out of the picture, but like he was working at a job and.
Oh yeah, he's had a full-time job for a long time. Never out of the picture. It goes in waves.
I guess I mean from like a day-to-day operations, like working together standpoint.
It's pretty consistent. It's just that it goes through quiet periods where it's like, hey, I need this or I have an issue with that. And yeah, he just kind of, I mean, he works hard. He works nights, he works weekends. It's a complicated product and he does everything. He does hosting, databases, front end, back end, tracker, JavaScript, PHP. You know, he has done everything, which is ridiculous. So that's when things started to get kind of real when Ben was up here in Portland. And so we needed to figure out a way to work together. And that's kind of what's been happening over the past few weeks. And I kind of had to play like dad a little bit. Like, listen, developer one, developer two, you guys are smarter than I am. You guys are both of equal caliber. Like, let's get me out of the way so you two can realize that working together is going to be phenomenal instead of one of you guys having to do this or having to do that. Once we got over that initial hurdle, that's kind of where we've been over the past few weeks. And then, things went from flirting to dating. And recently we got married.
Congratulations.
So thank you very much. I appreciate that. So we got the lawyers. We got the legal side of things done and drafted and signed and negotiated. And now, you know, now we have three co-founders, and that has changed everything. Mm-hmm. Changed the mindset, changed the game plan, the expectations, the potential. It's unbelievably exciting. It's, you know, money is like the point of business, but there's a lot that goes on beyond that, even cynical, you know, I can admit that. 2 years ago, when I had the idea and was sitting with Charlie in a coffee shop, asking him if he was kind of crazy enough to do this with me, it was amazing to get him on board and working together. And to go from there to now having myself work on it full time, another very high caliber person working on it full time. We got this sales consultant who's working on it a lot. We've got outsourced people working full time on it. Charlie working part time. It's like all of a sudden it's like this thing that lives and has momentum.
It's really exciting, man. I mean, to see the progress you've made over the last 2 years has been absolutely awesome. And like you said, like it's now here we are. It's like a real thing. And you know, your full time focus in 2015. So exciting stuff for sure.
Yeah. So I'm happy to just be able to share it. And I think there are lessons throughout there that I don't need to like point out or dissect. I think the main theme is, you know, don't wait for things to come to you, man. Go get them.
Yeah, make them happen for sure.
Yep. Cool, man. So let's jump into the episode.
Yep.
Topic.
And I think
decision making.
I think that a lot of what you just shared there, a lot of what's kind of going on with me has really prompted this episode, which is about making decisions. And you know, like you said, I mean, you, in the story you just shared, you know, there were a number of decisions that you made along the way. Whether it was, you know, getting on the phone with the guy flying down to LA,
saying no to the acquisition,
you know, every one of those,
how much equity to give these, you know,
the partnership, you know, all that. So like every one of those decisions, I'm sure, you know, we were talking about them as they were happening. Like you went back and forth and weighing different options and, you know, what ifs, the pros and cons, like the playing out different scenarios. You can do this all day, all week, all month, and all year long, but at a certain point, you have to decide one way or the other, and otherwise, everything else is going to suffer until the decision is made. And so that is something that I've really been thinking heavily about these past few weeks, because I've personally made some very big decisions, and I'm still making decisions right now, and it's been tough, but. But you know, something that I was listening to about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I was tuning into Amy Porterfield's podcast, which is called Online Marketing Made Easy, and it was her episode number 47 where she was interviewing her business coach, Todd Herman, and they were taking listener questions. And one of the questions was, "How can I overcome the fear of failure that constantly prevents me from making decisions?" And it was like, somebody asked this question and I was like, you know, they must have been reading my mind, because every time I have decision, I'm always faced with that fear of like, what if I make the wrong decision? Is this going to set me back? Am I going to regret this? You know, and all those things that go along with that. So Todd's answer made me kind of rethink this whole thing. And here's what it said. And I'm kind of paraphrasing this. This isn't his exact words, but this is basically what he was saying there. He was saying the most successful people are eager to make as many decisions as possible every single day. And they're eager to make those decisions as quickly as possible, given the information that they're faced with in the moment. So they're not afraid to make the wrong decision. In fact, they want to make some of those decisions to be wrong. And the reason is that because the reason for that is that they would result in learning opportunities. And the more wrong decisions that a person can make, that actually makes them smarter and wiser, and it makes them better at making more decisions in the future. And it helps them make those decisions faster, just simply from the fact of making a lot of decisions. And, you know, he went on to say that there's this common misconception where if you give more time to a decision, then that's going to reveal more information and bring more things to light, and that's going to help you find the right answer. If you just give it another day or another week to kind of, you know, debate back and forth. But that thinking is wrong. And so we make our best decisions based on our past experiences. And so we're much better off just deciding one way or the other and doing that quickly, using whatever information we happen to have at the moment, understanding that we probably don't have all the information, but just go with whatever you have in front of you, make a decision one way or the other, because the right decision is always going to be based on your past experience, whether that's experience from things that have gone right or experiences that from things that have gone wrong. That's going to, you know, I think this plays back into like trusting your gut. Like your gut is always going to, your gut reaction on anything has a lot of wisdom baked into it just from your living your life and your past experience.
Yeah. Even if you're not conscious of it.
Yep.
Reminds me of like multiple choice exams in high school.
Yes.
Right. Like your first instinct is usually the right one, as opposed to overthinking it. You know, that now it applies to more complex decisions, but doesn't necessarily mean it changes the structure of the getting to the right answer.
Yeah, absolutely. So you brought up another link. What was that?
So it's related, right? And yeah, this is a tricky topic because it's hard to train yourself. It's hard to change the way you normally do these things, right? If you're just someone who likes to sleep on it, who likes to take the extra time, it's very difficult to force yourself to make decisions more quickly. I think it's a struggle for most people. There are those people out there that are just super proactive and super decisive. I know personally, I'm not that decisive. That's my instinct is not to just bang, make the decision very, very quickly. But over time, you do realize that taking additional time, it just costs time more than anything. It does not necessarily lead to a better answer. And when you brought that up, it brought to mind an article I read. I don't know where I found it. It's an article from 2007. This is from Mark Andreessen. And he's talking about age and the entrepreneur. Basically, when is the ideal age for an entrepreneur to maximize their, their success rate? Or are younger entrepreneurs better because they're more risk loving, or older because they're more experienced? And so there's a lot of studies that go around not just entrepreneurship, but like creative output, whether that is art or math formulas or achievement of some type. So in the article, he talks about these studies and how one of the more interesting conclusions is that the quality of what you put out there, whether that's business, art, science, whatever it is, it doesn't vary nearly as much by age as we think. And because of that, right, let me just read his little piece on it. Mm-hmm. Quality of output does not vary by age, which means, of course, that attempting to improve your batting average of hits versus misses is a waste of time as you progress through a creative career. Instead, you should just focus on more at-bats, meaning more output. So in our situation, it's more decisions, more businesses, more projects, more things launched. And trying to focus on improving your, in this, he calls it your batting average, meaning how good you are at something. Like if you're an artist and, right, the analogy is if you're an artist that paints, you're much better off not spending an enormous amount of time on each painting, expecting to get better and that your next painting will be amazing because you just spent so much time learning. The analogy is really just keep painting.
Yeah.
And if you have 10 pieces of output and two of them are brilliant, the same thing would have happened if you had 100 outputs. 20 of them would have been fantastic. It doesn't really matter that over time your career changes. It's that you're kind of capable of what you're capable of. So you're really better off trying to put out there 100 businesses, 100 pieces of art, 100 paintings, and having 20 great ones instead of trying to really focus hard on getting better at this decision and getting more information and testing and figuring out and surveying your customers. And you're really much better off launching more marketing campaigns and more ads and more products. It's tied. It's proof that you should make decisions quickly because that will most likely lead to better outcomes.
Totally. And I think anyone, kind of creative minded can really relate to that analogy there, because I was listening yesterday to a podcast about music production and composers. I'm still kind of involved in that world as well. And the guy was saying, he was saying that he tries to write a new song, to be used somewhere like every day. And like last week he created one that was just killer, like out of the park, really worked for the application that he was writing for. And then the next day it was like crap. And at that point, you can like totally psych yourself out, by like, how can I not match the quality that I did yesterday? But you have to go into it thinking like every day, if you're just creating, you're still going to have this more or less the same batting average. You have to go into it knowing there's power in numbers, even in like creative, output.
I agree. There's a tension though. If you think about your own career, I have launched a relatively high number of different businesses since I started, right? Since I left the investment banking world, I probably put out there, I don't know, 8 or 10 like actual business attempts. The problem is I see how, call it 2 or 3 of those can be called moderate successes. But the issue is I always feel like the next one, it's going to be better than the previous ones. Like I just learned all these painful mistakes, all these issues, all these different, you do learn over time.
Yeah.
It's, I guess what it is, it's a problem of surrendering to fate and saying, I'm just going to try my hardest. I don't actually have that much control over this next business being a success. I just have to trust that I'm learning along the way, but it's not guaranteed to be better than the previous ones.
Yeah.
But if it doesn't work out, move on and launch another one. That one has it better off.
And I think this gets back into like patience with the whole idea of making progress over a long extended period of time, right? Like a batting average analogy, right? I mean, a hitter will, you know, over time get better until they get past their prime or whatever. But like as they're getting better, as they're learning the game, as they're progressing in the game, they're going to get incrementally better, like one season to the next season to the next season. But they're not going to get better exactly one day to the next day to the next day. The increase in the batting average is only going to happen after 162 games. You know, so you have to go into it like
there. I know, who has the patience,
right? I think these number, it's a numbers game on like so many levels, right? Like you might try 3 different marketing campaigns this month and see incremental progress, or you might start 3 different businesses over the course of 5 years and two might work out and one not, you know?
Right. It's easy to, you know, have a different AdWords campaign and say, oh, it's a numbers game. It's returning X amount. So let's let it run. Who cares? When it's like years of your life on a business, it's much harder to have patience. So it's almost like that's like too big.
Yeah.
I think where this is more useful, like that you can acknowledge as true in your career, and you can't really act on it. You can like, right. if this one's a failure and I chalk up these 18 months to, you know, whoops, it didn't work out, the next one will be better. That's like too hard. But where you can apply it is when something comes across your desk and you have to make a decision. Whether it's, should I hire this intern or not? Should I work with this person? Should I hire this person to redo my marketing site? You know, right now I'm redoing the marketing site. Good example. I don't know what the right message is. It's a guess. Mm-hmm. I could spend weeks on it and say, I'm going to get it right. I'm going to survey my customers. I'm going to call everyone. And yes, you should do some of that. But at some point, you have to just make a decision. The truth is, I would have been better off a month ago just going with what my gut was at the time, with the information that I had at the time, and right now have a marketing site that's new with one specific message and then start getting feedback on it.
Right.
And right? That's what Rob did with Drip. He was like, I didn't have it right. Oh, no, not Rob. I'm sorry. Nathan Barry with ConvertKit, that great post he just put
out. Yeah, that was good.
On how to get to 5K, he had it completely wrong. And he learned that only because he just launched with a guess and then heard back.
Right. And I wouldn't say he had it completely wrong either. I would say that's what this is. That's what building a SaaS app is. It takes so much time and so much trial and error. You know, nobody gets it right with the gradual increase or hockey. There's no hockey stick growth. We all know that. But even the gradual increase in growth doesn't happen overnight. It takes so much trial and learning and making a lot of decisions and making a lot of mistakes before you can get to the stuff that works. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, one thing that I've been thinking a lot about lately is this idea of like, as we go forward in business and getting more experience and doing more things and making more decisions, you know, do we actually get better at decision making or not necessarily get better or worse, but like, is it easier or is it harder as we go on? And I'm starting to feel right now that it's getting harder for me the longer I've been at this. I don't know if that's maybe the fact that I'm getting a little bit older, have a family now, have a little bit more on the line than I did back in my 20s, you know, that could play into it.
Yeah. But I think that's the big contributor.
I think so too. I think another one though is that, and this is probably the less healthy contributor, is that I look back on a lot of decisions that I made in the last couple of years, and I've done a lot of things that I am very proud of, and I learned a lot of lessons the hard way, which I'm proud of those lessons as well. But there are decisions that I can look back on and say, I made the wrong call there, and I can see what it cost me. Like, it cost me this many months of a setback or something like that, you know? And you know, you can't dwell on that stuff, when I'm faced with a new decision with very similar things at stake, it's hard to take these decisions lightly now. Whereas a couple of years ago, I would have just said, fuck it, let's just go with this and do it, you know?
Yep. I think both of those play into it. Past regrets, which we all have a healthy size mountain in back of us of, and the stakes being higher. You know, sometimes I feel like some people I know who are, I don't know how to say this, less introspective, right? They're not any less smart. They just think about this stuff less. They're just more okay with just making a decision, moving forward. Mm-hmm. You know, and sometimes you'll see successful people that way, that they don't dwell on past mistakes, and their ego and their confidence just kind of stays consistent, and they just barrel through a lot of things that leaves other people scratching their heads. Like, how do they have the balls to do that?
Yeah.
It's also when the stakes get raised and you have a family and all that. And you know, that's why I tried really hard to become financially successful before having a wife and kids, because I knew that doing that ahead of time would free you up. It'd give you more freedom and be able to take more risk. And I was not able to do that. So it's harder when the stakes are raised.
Yeah, it is. And I look back on when I made the decision to quit my job and become a freelance web designer. And I remember the main justification I had for that at the time was, well, I'm single. I don't have a mortgage to pay. If I'm going to do this thing, I'm going to do it now. And that's what I was telling my parents at the time. That's what I was telling my friends.
What's the downside?
Like, what's the downside, you know?
Do it for a year. At worst, move back into your parents' house for a few months and kind of get a job.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
That's not that bad.
And now I feel like, you know, I don't have those same excuses anymore. But I still want to take the same kind of risks.
That's the danger is that not only are you more careful in your decision making to a fault, and you're more risk averse. So it's like not only are the decisions more important and have a bigger downside, you're also making worse decisions because you're scared and you're constrained and you're worried about this and you're looking at past regrets. It's a really hard thing to kind of get over. I think a lot of people struggle with this. And it's easy to envy people who at least appear to be making more decisions more quickly with less, less worry about the downside.
Yeah. But, you know, like, I think like with anything else, there is a balance, and it does depend on what type of decision it is, you know, and understanding what's at stake. You know, you don't want to go into things blindly, and you do want to give things a certain amount of time. I also kind of put together a couple of tips that I've been thinking about lately. And just trying to, you know, these are things that I've been trying to change in my approach to making decisions more recently. So, you know, one is asking for advice from advisors. And this is something that that I think I mentioned around the turn of the year when we talked about like goals for this year or things that we want to improve. I feel like in recent years, I really only relied on myself or didn't even share a lot of what I was thinking about with the people around me. And now I'm making a conscious effort to try to just ask for advice, not be afraid to ask for advice from people. And so I'm talking about like advisors, like within the mastermind groups, friends who do this type of stuff for a living really help, but also other friends and family, even people who aren't necessarily entrepreneurs or, you know this field and whatnot, but they know you, they're close to you, and they they can give you feedback in different ways. So, you know, I've been asking my wife for plenty of advice, my parents, my brother, you know, there's a lot of value in just running through the thought process and the things at stake and kind of explaining what's going on and just
saying it out loud.
Yeah. Saying it out loud and getting their take and their feedback on it. But
seeing their responses to what you're saying, like their
gut. Yeah. Their gut instinct. I think the big but here though, is that it's too much to ask them, what should I do? Like, it's not their place to tell you what to do. And that goes for advisors, friends, family, everyone. Their only role in this is to kind of give you feedback and support you in your decision. You know, and I'm starting to really learn that because it's too much to ask, and it's not the right thing to ask someone like to have that sort of responsibility for you. And nobody wants to tell you what to do or what not to do. You know, and honestly, at the end of the day, it's your decision to make, and you can only go on the things that you know. But the feedback that you get, you know, just people telling you, well, you know, it sounds like you're saying this, and these are the things that I know about you. So, you know, that's what I'm hearing you say. That kind of feedback can be really valuable as you're trying to go through these like big decisions.
Yeah. I like to listen to myself in those situations. Like as I'm coming to someone for advice, let's say I'm coming to my wife and saying, hey, should I write, let's say the acquisition was a big decision. I would listen to myself and which side of the decision I was defending. Mm-hmm. Right. So you're like talking to someone, you're like, yeah, but this, and this is good about this side of the decision, but then there's this downside. But then on the other side, there's always something wrong with the other decision also. Right. So you're making these arguments to yourself, but you hear your bias and like which one you're defending a little bit more and which one you're just kind of throwing out there and which one you're positioning in a better light than the other.
Exactly.
Right? And the bias that comes through in the way you describe it is like, huh, that's where my gut is.
And very often, I've seen this happen a number of times, is the feedback that you get from someone as you run it by them, typically it's something along the lines of, well, as you're describing it, I can hear your decision is already made, and it sounds like you're coming to me for permission to take option A instead of option B. And you know, that kind of reaction is telling in itself, you know?
Yeah. That's an honest friend or mentor.
You know, another idea that I've been thinking of lately is just set a deadline, just a little tip for, you know, you know, you have this decision to make. You know, you can't move forward. You can't start executing on any sort of plan until some kind of strategic decision is made. So you got to say, all right, this Friday, I'm going to decide one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's very healthy. I have horrible discipline. And so what I do is I set a deadline with somebody else. And that's one of the things that having a co-founder working on this full-time with me has improved productivity. Because when I say, I'm going to get you X by Thursday,
right,
there are a lot of micro decisions around producing X. Like, I will get you the copy for the new marketing site by Thursday. There are so many decisions that need to be made about what headline, what structure, what pricing page, and the deadline just forces you to make all these decisions more rapidly. Because like, I have to get this Google Doc shared by Thursday, or I'm a slacker. I didn't do what I said I was going to do. So it helps like steamroll right over a lot of the difficult decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. Two more kind of quick ones here. You know, just remember the upside of making a wrong decision. So as you're weighing, you know, the pros and cons and the different scenarios of like option A versus option B, just remember that you can go into this decision knowing that maybe it's like a 50-50 chance that you'll make the wrong decision on this one. But even if you do, there's an upside to that, because you're going to learn a really good lesson that you can take with you into the next thing. And I think this comes back to I in many times in my career so far, I've had this mentality of, I just want to get to the first try so that I can screw up a lot of things and then get to the second try, because I know the first thing is not going to work out. And I think part of that relates to making decisions because, you know, in general, you might be like 50-50 or whatever. You're going to make wrong decisions. You have to go in knowing that and just expect to learn some lessons from it.
I think the hard thing with this piece of it, like focusing on, look, what's the worst that can happen? You know, you make a bad decision, you learn. Where it becomes difficult is people convince themselves, myself included, that they can't go back, that this is a final decision, that if they make this decision, then they can't go back on it, they can't change it, which is almost never right. If I decided to change my pricing completely and change the marketing site and put it out there, and I mean, no one knows, no one cares. You know, the audiences are so small, it's not like the Wall Street Journal is going to say, oh, Cardhook chain went back to their original pricing. Like, nobody cares. You can make these mistakes and just go right back on them.
Yeah, exactly.
And no one will even notice.
Very, very, very few things are irreversible, right?
Yep.
And I think the thing that we risk, though, is time. How much time is the wrong decision going to set me back here? And again, it's just not something that you really have control over. You have to kind of, at the end of the day, make a decision one way or the other and accept that, yeah, it might result in a setback, but that setback also results in a huge lesson that you're going to be faced with the same decision again at some point.
And brings it sooner.
And at that point, you're going to work off of much better information, you know, because we always learn from our experience. The last one that I had here, and I guess we've kind of touched on this quite a bit is trust your gut, you know. And I was talking to a friend yesterday, asking for advice, explaining what I'm faced with and what I'm trying to figure out. And he told me, you know, he asked me, look, listen, this question has helped me in the past. And that is, you have a gun to your head. You have to decide one way or the other right now. What is it? And that question usually just brings the right answer immediately forward, you know, because that's what your gut is. What is your gut telling you? You're leaning one way or the other just right now, you know, and that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to commit to that decision today. Maybe you still want to give it another day or two or something like that, but at least just asking that question tells you exactly, all right, I know where my gut is, you know?
Yeah. I think that's like the ultimate. You know, at some point, whatever, if it's going to be a deadline, asking people, worrying about this, at some point, that question needs to be addressed. And that's probably what you should do. And don't worry about the consequences and this and that, and it's irreversible. I think we would all be better off if we asked ourselves that question. A lot of the decisions, the things that stay on your to-do list for, you know, 2 months, what would you do if someone put a gun to your head right now? Just say the answer right now. And you're probably better off doing that today or tomorrow as opposed to waiting another month until you make the decision.
Yep, absolutely.
I'm going to listen to this podcast a few times to take our own advice.
Yeah, me too. And you know, the other, I guess like one more quick one that I just thought of is the journal. And I forgot how much I personally rely on this, especially in recent months. Every day that I'm thinking through different decisions, I guess on the one hand, this might be causing me to take more time to decide, but at the same time, I find it really helpful to just write down all of my thoughts, different scenarios, pros and cons, downsides, upsides, worst case scenarios, best case scenario. You know, I write all this stuff down and just get it out of my head and written down. And number one, it helps me analyze and think things through more clearly rather than when it's all like trapped inside my head. Number two, it really helps me to go back and read from a couple of months ago where my head was at on something. Because I find that I get really caught up in the moment about getting excited about a new direction. And that really clouds out the other options that are on the table. And I can look back and it also helps me like internalize the lessons of wrong decisions. Is I can look back at what I wrote at the time and
diagnose
and kind of just see where my head was at and what I was seeing and what I was not seeing at the time, you know.
Yeah, the last thing I want to say about decision making, I think this is more in the context of a group of people trying to make a decision. What I like to use is is the question of what's your ideal? Like, because sometimes in a group, people start assuming things and they start putting these weird barriers in place oh, Jordan, I assumed that you didn't want to spend this much money on a CRM because that sounds expensive. Or I heard you say something 3 weeks ago about how this other tool is expensive and this is the same price. So I'm not even going to bring this up in as one of the options. You know, so, and you don't know about all these assumptions that people hold. So what I like to ask is, what is your ideal? No constraints, no assumptions, nothing. If you close your eyes, what would that ideal be? And then describe that, and then let's see how close we can get to it.
Yep.
Is it, at least it like lowers everyone's, you know, built up assumptions and this weird web of like expectations. Like, I don't want to suggest something because then they're going to think something of it. So, I mean, CRM, this is one of the big decisions we've made over the past few weeks. It was a difficult decision. Everything has a pro and a con and this, and it integrates with this, but it doesn't integrate with that. And at some point, it was just like, look, what's our ideal? We can't get all the way there in a reasonable way. So let's back up one stage, and that's what makes sense for us now. So let's do it.
Yeah. Cool. It's good talk today. And
yeah, as I always, think it's a good sign when at the end of the podcast, both of us are like,
okay, we can press stop now. this was really good. And as always, if you guys have any feedback on what we're talking about here today, we definitely want to hear it. So you know, shoot us a tweet, email, whatever works for you. Keep the conversation going. And as always, you can dig into the backlog of episodes by heading over to bootstrappedweb.com. And if you're enjoying the show, we appreciate it. Head over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review. That always helps us connect with more listeners, and we always appreciate that. We'll see you guys next week.
Talk to you soon.
All right. Later.
See you, bud.
Later.